Hello, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm Linda Palacio, and I'll be your host for the next half hour here on Heritage Radio Network. And today we are very pleased to be served by, to be sponsored, that is, by TechServe. TechServe is New York's premier authorized Apple reseller, service provider, serving individual customers, creative professionals, and Fortune 100 companies. TechServe has built a solid reputation on its expertise in technology, sales, and service. As a company that believes in honest and forthright business practices, TechServe is proud to sponsor Heritage Radio Network in the promotion of sustainable lifestyles. Today, we've got a great day in New York today. It is warm, it is sunny, and I'm just waiting for the good humor truck to come around the corner. And not that I'm going to buy anything, but it all just always makes me think of summer and makes me think of cheerful times. And to celebrate this wonderful weather and the spring and summer approaching, I have invited as my guests the author of the International Association of Culinary Professionals Award for Culinary History. The author is Jerry Quinzio, and her book is Of Sugar and Snow, The History of Ice Cream Making. Welcome, Jerry.
Thank you.
And bringing us into a more modern era, we have the owner and founder of Il Laboratorio del Gelato, John Snyder, with his mother, Phyllis. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to start with Jerry. Jerry, I think that most people, I mean, they remember their own first ice cream experiences.
Sure.
Last night, I invited Jerry. We had the Culinary Historians of New York had a wonderful event where Jerry was the guest speaker, lecturer, and we tasted artisanal ice creams and drank a lot of Prosecco. And we learned a lot about the history of ice cream. And I thought, what a wonderful thing to share with my listeners as well. And a lot of people are sort of confused or maybe never really thought about the history when ice cream really began to be made. And you are our resource. It's been around a long time. How long has it been around?
Well, basically, it's been around since about early in the 17th century in Europe. It took a little while because they had to figure out how to freeze something. They really didn't know that. And once they understood that adding salt to ice enabled them to freeze, say, a drink or a pudding-type confection, then they knew how to make ice creams and sorbets. And once they started, there was just no stopping them. And they just came up with amazing flavors and styles of serving. It was pretty incredible. And this was long before anyone had a freezer or a refrigerator.
That's right. Imagine in the 1600s, these incredible ice cream. Well, you talked about an ice cream buffet. People thought, well, you know, we were the fancy ones, you know, in the modern age to invent mix-ins and flavors. And in fact,
as far back as I think early in the 18th century, confectioners would fool diners by making a whole buffet table full of ice creams sort of disguised as slices of turkey or leg of lamb or even a fish. Peaches, asparagus. They love to make asparagus molded ice creams. So they would invite guests in, and the guests would seem to have a buffet table of meats and fish and vegetables, and then they'd sit down and start to eat and discover everything was made of ice cream.
And they were all flavors, right? Fruit flavors.
All kinds of flavors.
This really, take that one, SpongeBob ice pop. A turkey leg or a whole turkey, in fact,
a whole
right?
turkey, yeah. A whole fish. And they would talk about coloring the molds, the ices in the molds. Then one confectioner says, excuse me, when you do a fish, make sure that you color the underside of the fish lighter than the top side, because fish bellies are always pale.
So they were just like the antique Romans. They were really into realistic disguise. Well, even in like 12th, 13th century England, there was a lot of that.
Yeah.
Too. Well, stuffed swans.
Sort of
you had it, and you talked about it. Yeah, faux food. Stuffed swans. I mean, or swan shapes, you know.
Yeah, all sorts of things. They were very, very creative and inventive. And when you think about how difficult it was to actually make ice cream then, you really have to give them a lot of credit for patience and hard work and skill.
Absolutely. Well, then I'm sure that there were ices. Well, you talked about, even in prior to the 17th century, some ices, some freezing of wines and things.
What? Yeah, when they started out, they were just experimenting.
Who are we talking about, they?
Actually, scientists in the 16th century wanted to learn how to freeze whatever, and they tried wine. Well, wine won't freeze solid, but it does get slushy. So for a period, the very elites of Europe had wine slushies with their banquets for quite a while.
You know, I think that's going to be my summer dessert
summer drink
for my dinner parties. It sounds great to me, a wine slush. I mean, how bad is that?
Absolutely.
Well, of course, a lot of people, everyone hears the myths about Catherine de' Medici, and you dispelled that myth immediately in your book.
Yeah,
and she's from everything from forks to artichokes, and she's not the one, huh?
She's not the one, and neither was Nero or any of the others that people think invented ice cream or brought ice cream from Italy to France. I'm afraid she didn't. She was a very young girl when she married and went to France, and she really didn't have that kind of influence, even if they had the skill, which at that point, they really didn't.
I'm sure the myths were probably started by her family. I mean, they had enough power that they could spread the word about anything, right? Well, you did mention the Italians, however. And, of course, we know that Antonio Latini wrote in Lo Scalco della Moderna, the modern cook, he wrote about ices. Right?
He was probably one of the very first to have recipes for ices and ice, and actually not in ice cream, but an iced milk that I think was kind of a predecessor of ice cream. And he had lots of what we would think of as sorbets.
Well, that's funny. We're just going to talk about how the circle turns ice milk. But then, bringing it up to more of the 19th century, it came to the common people. I mean, ice cream could not be purchased in a store. It always had to be made fresh. There were no freezers. There was no way to keep the ice cream. So tell us how did they get ice cream to the people?
Well, basically, they started, a man named Frederick Tudor started the ice industry and made ice available. So once ice is available and inexpensive, then you can do more. Then Nancy Johnson invented a new kind of ice cream freezer that was much easier to use. It had a crank. Instead of having to open it and stir it as you were making the ice cream, you could just crank it. So between her cranked freezer and his cheap ice, suddenly people were making ice cream at home. Hmm. And you see recipe books just filled with recipes for ice cream. It seems to be sort of a weekend popular thing to do, that you all get the family together and
well,
make
and
ice
that,
cream.
And her, what? When did she invent that hand crank freezer?
That was, I believe, 18...
So it was in the 1800s.
Yeah.
And that really is a direct predecessor of all our modern crank ice creams that we have now. I mean, they're electric now. I mean, but a lot of the... And John, I mean, I don't know what type of ice cream... Well, you have.
No, we have the commercial.
You have large commercial machines.
But they still sell hand crank models.
Yeah.
And plenty of people
yeah.
have
I have an
those
old.
They work very well.
Yeah. I had an old Danvier one. You put the container in the freezer. Yeah. And put it in and crank it.
They still sell that type. Anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
But many manufacturers sell that Danvier type, sure.
But then there sprung up these places where people could go. And, I mean, there were ice cream vendors, I imagine, in parts of Europe, right?
There were ice cream street vendors on sort of one level, and then
which haven't gone away, fortunately.
Fancy ice cream confectioner's shops where the more elite would go and have a sort of dainty ice cream. Or you could buy ice cream on the street and eat it out of what they called a licking glass.
Uh-huh.
So a licking glass, or a penny lick,
right,
was... just a small glass. The vendor would fill the glass with ice cream. He wouldn't give you a spoon, though, because he didn't want you to walk away with his glass and spoon.
We had no plastics at that time.
No plastics, no cardboard cartons. So you had to stand there and lick the ice cream out of the glass. and then return it, and he would wash it.
Yeah, right.
But
I'm sure the Department of Health had a few things to say.
I don't think the water was heated to a point that would kill bacteria.
Well, in fact, there was a problem with the Department of Health shutting them down.
There was a big problem with that sort of thing, and it resulted in a lot of the pure food and drug laws that we have even today.
So then someone came up with a great idea, which lasted until well into my adulthood, was the hokey pokey, although we didn't call it a hokey pokey. Tell us what hokey pokey is.
Hokey pokey was...
aside from a dance, right?
Yes, it was a dance and a song. It was, if you imagine a loaf of ice cream, I think is the easiest way to describe it, often three layers of flavor, like vanilla, chocolate, and strawberry.
Neapolitan.
And they would just take a slice, so it would be almost like a slice of bread, but actually a good deal smaller, and wrap it in paper. So then you could walk away with your ice cream. You had something to hold on to, and you weren't licking it out of someone else's glass, which was a big improvement.
Well, now, these ice creams, as far as the recipes go, were they all custard-based ice creams that you know of in your research, by and large?
A lot of them were custard-based. So it was really...
meaning, you know, they all contained eggs.
Eggs,
right?
And milk and cream and sugar and then whatever flavoring. But there also is a whole sort of school of ice cream, and I'm sure John knows about this, called Philadelphia ice cream, which is just cream, sugar, flavoring. No eggs. And some people like it because they feel it's lighter and fresher. It has a cleaner mouthfeel. Some people prefer the custard base because it's rich and lush. It's just a matter of personal preference.
Mm-hmm. Well, as that change came along, a lot of other changes came along, too, with the Industrial Revolution and modernization in food techniques. Gave us the cake mix and TV dinners, but we also... it kind of bastardized ice creams as we knew it, right?
It did. We got a lot of big, fluffy, airy ice creams.
And ice milk became, it became affordable to the general public,
right,
who couldn't afford maybe, a true good ice cream would be a little prohibitive for a lot of people to buy. But an ice milk would be cheaper.
Right? Yes, and also just pumping ice cream with a lot of air so that instead of buying what people used to buy, a half pint, which is pretty small when you think about it, they suddenly were able to buy a half gallon and put it in their freezer. They had a new freezer at home, so they could buy half gallons and put them in their freezer, and they were very affordable. Unfortunately, the quality of the ice cream was not very good.
Well, and from personal experience, I would tell you, you had to eat a lot of it to get any sense of satisfaction.
Exactly.
I mean, we would go... our treat every weekend for a family of four kids, my mother would buy 2 half gallons of whatever the, flavors voted on of the week. And that was usually a Seal Test or some, store brand light ice milk, inexpensive. And, we'd take 3-4 scoops in a bowl and then slather it with Hershey's chocolate syrup or something, just to get a sweet hit, because it really was. It just, now I think about when I take a scoop of Il Laboratorio del Gelato, or some of these wonderful other artisanal brands that are coming about, you don't need more than a scoop or two, and it is dense and rich, and you are satisfied. Well, along with that, and those the cheaper brands of ice creams came the novelty ice creams as we know them, the Eskimo pies and
popsicles.
And tell us about ice cream sandwiches. I think that's a great story from your book.
Yeah, ice cream sandwiches came along just about the turn of the 20th century. And we think they were actually created by an ice cream vendor downtown New York who probably, this is a little bit of conjecture on my part, but probably saw people wrapping the paper around the hokey pokey and said, why not put cookies around the pokey pokey kind of ice cream instead, came up with the idea of an ice cream sandwich, and it was just wildly popular. Everyone started imitating it, and one newspaper wrote that, in fact, it was so popular that Wall Street brokers would stand on the sidewalk right next to messengers and clerks and buy an ice cream sandwich.
Oh, heavens. Well, on that note, we're going to take a little break and wait for the Good Humor Man. And when we come back, we're going to jump into the modern era of ice cream. Sorry, we came back so soon. We are eating ice cream. John Snyder of Il Laboratorio del Gelato has a very interesting story about bringing us back to the modern era of, well, his story is not the modern era. He is the modern era. But as Jerry was describing, Jerry Quinzio, the author of Sugar and Snow. I love that, that title, by the way. Ice cream kind of went through the large industrialization, and then it took a while before all of a sudden we're seeing, springing out of every corner, artisanal or artisan-style ice creams. And John, you really did some research to find out how to make some of these ice creams. And
yeah, well, my story started more with my family in that industrial when ice cream was coming of age in the earlier part of the century, because my grandfather was a contractor, and he built a lot of the Carvel stores in the metropolitan New York area. And the last one he built, he kept in 1951. And my grandparents ran that store with my mom and her sisters. And
we have mom here, Phyllis. Welcome.
Thank you.
It was a big family business that I would work at in the summertime. It was one of those summer stands that was closed that you drive up to. You don't go inside. It was closed in the winter, so it was a seasonal business. And I worked there in the summertime from the age of 9 until pretty much 16, 17 with my cousins and aunts and uncles. And that was where I really got a foothold into small business ownership, and ice cream got into my blood. And of course, Carvel is a very different product to what I'm doing today. But right. I took a trip to Italy when I was 18 years old, just a summer vacation with a cousin of mine, and kind of just fell in love with what was going on in Italy. That was in 1983, and I was 19, and just was like really consumed by what they were doing over there. I never had tasted anything like it. Consuming a lot of it. And you know, it sort of turned into a working vacation, because immediately I said, well, this would be really great to bring something like this back to New York. And so this vacation turned into got some recipes, talked to a lot of people, and my Italian was kind of rusty, but I had taken Italian was my language in high school, so had a little bit of a background of that. Came back to New York, quit school, much to my mom and dad's chagrin, and started Ciaubella. The Ciaubella Gelato Company in Soho,
I think is pretty much nationwide.
Yeah, I had it for the first 6 years, and then I sold it, mm-hmm. and the guy I sold it to, he really took it national. When I had it, it was very much a Manhattan, New York brand. We were focused on soliciting chefs in New York and knocking on doors and cold calling to chefs and getting a foothold in kind of a small wholesale business, artisanal wholesale business, because we were trying to do it the right way.
Now, when you say the right way, give us a little explanation about what you mean by
well,
that.
Focus.
Well, first of all, Phyllis, when you were working at Carvel, I mean, Carvel made ice cream, but then they really bumped into the business with the soft serve, correct?
Oh, yes, yes. And it was very easy, though. I mean, the vanilla flavor just came already mixed, and we would just put it in the hopper, and it would run through the machine.
It would freeze as it came out.
Right, right. Uh-huh. And it's the same as with the chocolates. Mm-hmm.
But it was good. That was good quality.
Oh,
I remember
it was.
Carvel was
the
always
soft
a better
ice
quality.
Cream yeah. that people loved.
Right.
Yeah.
So when
yeah.
you say you were going by good methods, tell us what those methods are while I take a bite of some of this gelato.
I think it's what, also just to touch on that, it's what made Carvel successful. I mean, it was good. Mm-hmm. But it was easy for the operator to make it because it wasn't any mixing involved. It was just get it from the Carvel factory, the mixture, pour it in the machine, comes out, and it made it simple for the small business owner to open those shops, and it was delicious, and the branding and the design of the store was cool, and it kind of worked into the 50s, 40s, 50s, 60s of American.
And hey, they're still around.
Sure, sure.
And I drive by Tom Carvel's old property every weekend going upstate.
Westchester,
yeah,
sure.
And they're, well, no, the further up in Dutchess County, the or is it Westchester? The golf course.
Because in Westchester, they've... it's not there anymore.
Right, right. But the golf course, his estate and the property with the golf course is up there.
Yeah. Is it further up? Yeah.
Yeah.
So this trip to Italy really just inspired me to bring something back that was different and better and more interesting. I mean, I was over there and just these interesting flavors like licorice and rice and things that I just never experienced at Baskin-Robbins.
Rice-flavored ice cream?
Sure. I just saw the creativity there in Italy that I hadn't seen here as a kid. I mean, I was pretty wet behind my ears, but I just always had an appreciation for ice cream and for interesting flavors. And there, I was impressed. So it was, I was in school. I wasn't really set on what I was going to do with the rest of my life, so I decided to give school a pause and open this open Ciaobella up with about $20,000 borrowed from family mostly, and it was about knocking on cold calling on chefs and building up this small business that eventually became a solid enough business that I could sell.
Well, now we were talking about big industry getting into the ice cream making business, and what they did was they discovered a lot of stabilizers, right? Stabilizers and gums and things that they could, powdered eggs that they could put into the mix. So you're going to tell me this is not in your ice cream, right?
Okay. Well, I'm one of the fans of a non-egg based ice cream, the more of the Philadelphia style. There's a reason for it. The eggs act as a natural stabilizer and emulsifier and helps greatly to smooth out and give a good, really great texture.
Texture is so important in ice cream.
It is. But what eggs, I just don't, there's something about the eggs that give a flavor that I don't think is as clean as a non-egg base. So to compensate for that, We use a couple of natural gum-based stabilizers. Mm-hmm. There's seaweed-based stabilizers, guar gum and carrageenan, which is just the necessary component if you're not using eggs. I feel like you need to have that. Otherwise, it becomes a very gritty, very icy texture.
It does not hold up well either.
No.
What about the cream? What creams do you use?
An organic cream from upstate New York. We try to use organic in the laboratorio. We try to use organic when we can. We don't really claim to be organic because we make over 200 flavors and it's too difficult to source everything organic. But we try when we can, and I do use an organic cream. The sugar is not. The sugar is just a basic cane sugar. Mm-hmm. When I can get organic fruit, I do, and we often do use, but not always. So
now I noticed. I saw that you've gotten into a few grocery stores. I don't know if they're just the gourmet stores. I saw them in Dean and DeLuca.
Yeah,
and
we're
Gourmet
just,
Garage.
We're just in a couple of markets. Not Gourmet Garage. Dean and DeLuca, Marie's Garage. Cheese, Beercraft in Park Slope carries a few pints. Really, that's just it. There's just like five places in the whole city that carries. It's mostly restaurants that we service.
And you only have one retail outlet, correct?
Yeah, well, we're just down, we make everything down on Orchard Street, just below Delancey on the Lower East Side. It's all made there, and then we have the window open to the public. And that's where everything's made that we service about 200 restaurants in New York City from.
So you really still are primarily carried by restaurants.
It's 90% of what we do is wholesale to restaurants. And that's really what drives the flavors that we do. Again, our flavor list is up to about 200.
Well, and I just tried a very interesting one here, basil ice cream. That it's really delicious.
Is that
and it has a really
yeah.
clean finish to it.
Yeah.
And I learned somebody was giving out tastes. Another one of these artisanal ones, Soco Creamery. They were giving out tastes the other day, and some woman came up and claimed to be, you know, the super aficionado of ice cream tasting. I'm saying, okay, what can I learn from her? All right, let's listen. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, of course, you always have to finish with a taste of vanilla anytime mm-hmm. you're tasting. Tell me, what is that? Do you know anything about that?
Well, I would usually say to start with vanilla. Whenever I go to a new place, I always try the vanilla. Because it's kind of the standard you know. Yeah, it's the most, I don't want to say flavorless, but it allows you to really taste what's the base more than anything mm-hmm. with that hint of vanilla. So I think it's a really good basic one to try. It really gives a good representation. If someone makes a good vanilla, then I think you're in pretty good shape that some of their other flavors are going to be really good as well.
But then why would you finish with a vanilla?
Well, I always say start. I wouldn't say
yeah,
finish.
Yeah, she was talking about finish as well. Because I'm a taster, I have to finish with vanilla. And I'm thinking, didn't make sense.
I would say the opposite because by the time you want to start, if you're doing a tasting, you want to start with the flavors that are more subtle first and then progress to something more intense. So your taste buds aren't masked by that.
If you had to, I would imagine from your sales, would say, what is the most popular of the unusual flavors? What is the most popular?
I mean, we sell more vanilla by far, it's also because of, it's mostly a restaurant trade that we do, and restaurants typically, they use a lot of vanilla.
And then, of course, ginger and ginger's popular, things like that.
Because they pair it with things. We do a lot of herbal things. I brought you a sample of the basil, and we do lavender and rosemary and
what
mint.
What is this one?
That's buttermilk, I believe. We do a lot of like dairy-based, like buttermilk, creme fraiche, sour cream, mascarpone, ricotta. Interesting. Cheddar cheese. A lot of
buttermilk. It has that tang. Yeah, that's great. And of course, you brought my favorite, which is salted caramel.
The salted caramel is very popular since we do a few different kinds of caramel. We try to offer, working with chefs, we try to be there for a chef that wants something unique for their menu. And that's why we make about 12 or 13 varieties of different chocolates, from dark chocolate, milk chocolate, white chocolate, chocolate with Thai chili peppers, and chocolate hazelnut, and mocha, and mocha milk chocolate malt. And so we try to offer as much as we can, and also collaborate with chefs that want us to create something new.
How many you say you have commercial ice cream makers, so how many flavors can you make in a day?
Well, we start the day very early. I generally get in these days, because we're so short on space, we're going to be moving to a much larger facility that's construction is actually starting today.
And the address in New York City is?
The new address is going to be 188 Ludlow at the corner of Houston Street,
and
which is right across the street from Katz's Deli.
Katz's Deli, all right.
The current store is on Orchard, just below Delancey. And we're going to keep the current store as a cafe, which is just four blocks away.
Oh, terrific.
We'll keep the original store, but... we'll be just up the block in a bigger space where people will be able to come inside. We're going to offer 50 flavors in the new shop.
Wow.
And the new shop will also, it'll be mostly about production, and there'll be a view in from the retail area, from the windows outside.
Kind of what Jacques Torres does with his chocolate.
Keeping it very open. People can really see the whole process.
So how many machines, tell me about these machines.
The machines that we use are Carpigiani machines. They're from Italy. It's actually the biggest Italian brand of ice cream machine.
And how much does it churn out in one making?
We have the largest Carpigiani machine, which puts out about 7 gallons in a batch.
So you think about it. I mean, still, it's really not a huge
amount of
ice cream.
They're not large commercial machines that Ben & Jerry's would be using. These are large machines for artisanal producers, basically.
Well, Jerry, you have some figures. You did some research on the per capita consumption of ice creams. And United States used to lead the pack. But tell us about that.
Well, we used to. We were up, I think, to about 22 quarts per person per year.
22 quarts a person.
That's nothing.
But
I can beat that.
That was advertising.
Well, you know what? We have to work harder, because it seems as if we've slipped a little. We're eating a little less ice cream. And the people in New Zealand have taken the lead.
Huh.
So I think that we should challenge America to eat more ice cream.
Eat more
I'm sure you agree, John.
I do. I've always heard Russia was a big consumer as well.
Russia, it's funny, we talked about that at the Culinary Historian event, Russia.
And one of the things, maybe you can confirm or deny this, I'd always heard in the States, Maine and Alaska were the biggest consumers, which always was, you know, flies in the face of people thinking warm weather states. Yeah. You'd have bigger per capita consumption. But.
Gee, I don't know. That's something I would have to look into. I always heard that Massachusetts was one of the biggest, but that may be because I'm from Massachusetts, so I'm not really sure. Yeah. But I don't think weather is such an indicator, because we eat ice cream all year round.
Right. That's true.
Yeah. And that's why it's actually one of the reasons, and people think that ice cream is a seasonal business, and it's not so seasonal for me. Building a wholesale business, because in a restaurant you'll have dessert year round. Oh, it's not, you'll never really think about it.
Your walk-in crowd at your retail shop,
retail obviously, for sure slows down. And, you're not going to have a cone walking down the street in January. But whole restaurants, year round, continuously buy about the same amount. You know, so it's
sure you get that fancy cake, and it always has a scoop of something interesting on the side.
If you're home or indoors, you'll have it. You'll have it 12 months of the
year.
Well,
I think that it is if you want to call it a movement, this artisanal type of ice cream. It really has taken hold. I mean, you were one of the early ones. 1983, that was very early. And I think every city has got a lot of small producers, and also a lot of gourmet food shops produce their own ice cream. Mm-hmm. Now, the machines, they have electric machines that make it
much easier nowadays.
Yeah, right. Impossible.
The last 5 years in New York, every really city, you're right, across the country, you've seen a lot of artisanal, and especially the last few years in New York, you've seen a lot in the outer boroughs. Interesting. It's fantastic, I think. I mean, I applaud it when you see these.
Oh, absolutely.
It's competition, but I think it's great.
That's good. That's a good thing.
It is good. Yeah. It means people are appreciating finer foods.
Well,
desserts.
I think we chalk you up as one of the first for New York, as bringing it to the people, and I would like to thank you for all these treats we have. I'm sure our engineer Nat Wiener and our producer Jack Inslee are going to appreciate these snacks after the show.
Good.
But Jerry Quinzio, I have to thank you for your informative and interesting information shared
this
with us.
Thank you. It's been fun.
And Phyllis and John Snyder, again, a pleasure to have you and learning
you.
So much about what's going on in the ice cream industry. So go out and buy a cone from your local artisanal dealer, right?
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. Again, I'm Linda Palacio. This has been A Taste of the Past, and we'd like to thank TechServe for being our sponsor today, and we hope you tune in again. Remember, all shows are archived on heritageradionetwork.com.
For appearing on A Taste of the Past today, Jerry and John will both receive 365-day gift cards from Zagat. Use this complimentary 365zagat.com gift card to enjoy trusted Zagat ratings and reviews derived from the opinions of 375,000 surveyors around the globe, all conveniently located in one place. For more information on Zagat, go to www.zagat.com. Thanks for listening.